Welcome to the Ricina podcast from the Observer Research Foundation. This episode examines the new contours of terror. It delves into the tools that states have to counter these threats, as well as asks whether the global response can adapt to new incubators of terror, particularly in the digital space. The panel, moderated by Yalda Hakim, is joined by General Bipin Rawat, Stephen Harper, Saad Mohseni, Gareth Bailey, and Aaron Saltman.
General, I've just returned from Syria, and there's no doubt that ISIS is regenerating. How do you see the threat of terrorism evolving?
Well, before we talk of the topic of the day, I would like to begin with by talking on the nature and the character of warfare. Well, wars will always be violent, and they will continue to be, there will continue to be more violence, whether it is warfare in the conventional sense or terrorism, because of the advent of technology, easy availability of weapons with the terrorists. And then we come down to the characteristics of warfare and the changing character of warfare. Well, I would like to compare this to the bill of fare on the banquet table today. As I said, I'll be talking about the banquet. Well, you have the soup getting served, which is comparable to the cyber warfare that is going to be launched before any combat. You'll have disruptions of military systems, civilian systems like the railways, power grids, and what have you. And just when the soup is over, you'll see that the starters have arrived, which will come in the form of missiles and drone attacks. And if that is enough, and this is something which will land in the hand of terrorists as well. So you will witness all this happening in terrorism. The future of terrorism is going to be as dirty as combat, conventional combat. So if the adversaries are quite satisfied with soup and starters, then they can go straight to the desert, which is the negotiating table, and start negotiating. And you feel that there's a happy ending to it. But that is not the way things will happen. You will have to go in for the main course. And main course is going to be mainly non-vegetarian. A lot of bloodshed on the battlefield, attrition, man-on-man combat, combat in the air, combat in the seas. And finally, when all that gets over, depending on who's the vanquished, you will finally get the desert served. And with the political masters and looking at the end state. So we might think that there is a happy ending to all that, and that everything will come to an end. But let us not forget that this banquet could well be attacked by a swarm of bees in the form of terrorists. So this war is not ending. The war on terror is something which is going to continue. We'll have to live with it until we understand and get to the roots of terrorism. So to say that, you know, the desert has been served and everything has come to an end, but don't forget, even at the end of that, there's a lot of cleaning to be done. The tables have to be cleaned, the dishes have to be washed, and a lot of things to be accounted for the damages. So therefore, what is the future of terrorism? The future of terrorism is that terrorism is here to stay. So long as there are going to be states that are going to be sponsoring terrorism, so long there are going to be states that are going to use terrorists as their proxies, make weapons available to them, make the funding for them, we cannot control terrorism. And therefore, what is the final end state that we wish to arrive at? We have to bring an end to terrorism, and that can only happen the way the Americans started after 9/11. They said, let's go on a spree on global war on terror and let the nations join together and fight terrorism together. Well, to do that, what do you have to do? You have to isolate the terrorists. Anybody who's sponsoring terrorism has to be taken to task. You cannot have partners who are partnering with you in the global war on terror and yet sponsoring proxies and terror.
You're referring to Pakistan.
I'm referring to any country which is sponsoring terror. Yes.
How do you deal with a problem like Pakistan?
Yeah, therefore the problem with this is you have to have an international messaging that has to go to them, hard action being taken. And I feel one of the measures that has been adopted is blacklisting by the FATF is one good measure. Diplomatic isolation. You have to do this. You have to bring about acceptability in the nation that yes, they are sponsors of terrorism. Denial of terrorism, to say that they are not denying it, they are themselves victim of terrorism, cannot continue for on and on. And I think we have to get the bull by these horns and take them to task.
So then I take it you're a supporter of the peace deal with the Taliban.
Yes, I do agree that you have to come to a peace deal with everybody. So if you have to come to a peace deal with them, you have to go for a negotiated peace. But in that, the Taliban or whichever organization is contemplating terror has to give up that weapon of terror. They have to come to the main table, they must come into the political mainstream, and then if they want to rule the country through the will of the people.
Well, they did once before, and we saw how that ended.
Oh, well, but they did, but yet they had the power of the gun behind them. When you have...
Do you think they'll have the power of the gun this time?
As of now, it is difficult to say, but I would say yes, they will.
So you think that Pakistan will continue to support, fund, back the Taliban if they were to return?
The answer is yes.
And what are the implications for the region?
Implications is that for some time you may be seeing a semblance of peace in Afghanistan, but finally it may be things back to normal. You have to basically change the ideology of the people who are residing in this area, the ideology behind Taliban, and only then can you bring in lasting peace in the region.
Does it make you angry that the Americans are negotiating with the Taliban?
No, not really angry. You finally have to come into the negotiation. But I think when you come into the negotiation, it must ensure lasting peace. It should not be just a temporary measure to find an exit. Today, the Afghan National Defense Force is emerging. They need support. They need technological support. They need air support. But let me tell you, they are doing a good job. We need to give them the credit. But that support must continue for some more time.
Gareth, the United Kingdom is often accused of being in Pakistan's corner when it comes to Kashmir, when it comes to various other issues. How do you respond to that?
Thank you, Yalda. Before I go into that topic, which I obviously imagined you would raise, I think it behooves us all here to pay tribute and remember the victims of terrorism. And while I'm here in Delhi, I want to remember that by the last count in 2018, some 340 Indians lost their lives to terrorists, and that is unconscionable. And the UK knows the suffering that a nation can bear when it loses its people to terrorist action. So I just want to record that and to record our sympathy and empathy with India today. To your point on Pakistan, and indeed, I think I know where the general is going. It is absolutely clear that terrorist groups are operating from within Pakistan. They pose a serious challenge to the government of Pakistan and to South Asia's regional stability. Absolutely clear. So what do you do about that? What you do about that, if you're the UK, is you engage, and you engage hard. You engage at every level, from the bottom to the very top. You engage regularly, and you set out in terms the importance of action against proxy groups and against terrorism and against extremism. And you know, I know very clearly that the charge is put that somehow the UK is close to Pakistan or too close to Pakistan, but it's just a simple matter of necessity. We have to be engaged with countries across South Asia, having robust conversations at all levels about what needs to happen and needs to happen urgently.
But does the general have a point when he says that for 18 years you've been supporting, backing, funding, they've been allies, and yet they haven't been offering the support that they should be in dealing with and cracking down on groups like the Quetta Shura?
It is clear that these sorts of enterprises are intergenerational in their duration. If I take Northern Ireland, the British government, I should say, began talks with the IRA 26 years before the Good Friday Agreement in 1972, the year of my birth. Disavowed, secret back channel, and that wasn't pleasant. That wasn't an easy thing to do, particularly at the time. That was an uncomfortable place in which to be. And it signaled just how hard the yards are, how long the path is for one to have to tackle terrorism. 18 years into the UK's latest commitment to Afghanistan, it feels extremely hard. But at the same time, to the point that's previously been made, I feel that what the United States are doing is innovative, courageous, enterprising, and really trying to push for that settlement, that long-term settlement that you've both implied needs to happen.
There are those who argue that just the way the United States took decisive action against, say, Qasem Soleimani. They should be doing the same thing in the sanctuaries in Pakistan.
I think, first thing, you point out that the issue of terrorism and proxy terrorism is a global phenomenon. You have different manifestations worldwide. And as you have different manifestations, so you require different responses. Responses have to be tailored to the situation at hand. Now, on Iran, the UK government has put it on record that we do not lament the passing of Qasem Soleimani. At the same time, we've made equally clear that the way forward is restraint, and that the way forward is to achieve a return to, in the Middle East region, enduring political settlement on the basis of compliance with international law and the rules-based system.
Can I just pick up on that with you, General? Do you think that there should be more decisive action when it comes to these sanctuaries in Pakistan?
Well, yes, that's what I alluded to. I said, yes, there needs to be decisive action. With Pakistan, we are looking at blacklisting by the FATF. That is one measure. And if finally that doesn't yield results, then you've got to go in for decisive action. Yes, I do agree with you.
Saad, we've just spoken to the General about the regional implications here of a peace deal. Domestically, though, how does that impact things in Afghanistan as far as terrorism is concerned, if there is a peace deal that's been struck?
Well, I think that the Taliban narrative that they have won is obviously is one that dominates now in Afghanistan, that they have forced the Americans to do this deal. And the unfortunate thing is that 20 years after 9/11, that it is the Americans sort of giving up and walking away from Afghanistan. Not just Afghanistan, we're seeing it in Syria, and we may see it in Iraq. So the world, I think, has, you know, this global front to fight terror. It seems to be on retreating to an extent. And one of the concerns that I have is that people always talk about the Taliban or ISIS or different organizations and how we've defeated them. Radical violent Islam as an idea is still well and alive and stronger than ever before. So I think that collectively we're not doing things right. But you know, to the General's point, I mean, I think it's going to be impossible to defeat these ideas and these organizations if they have sanctuaries, if they have outside state support from not just Pakistan, but other countries as well in the region. And I think that that's what we have to have, a very grown-up approach to this. I just read the Afghanistan chapter of a senior U.S. official's book, which is coming out later this year. I mean, his point was that we have fought 18 wars in Afghanistan 1 year at a time. That I think that, you know, it's much more tactical than strategic. We don't actually take a step back and think through the consequences of our actions. And, you know, the concern that we have is groups like the Taliban. I mean, even if we do a deal with the Taliban, the concern that we have is that the group will fragment. The more radical elements will still resist.
And a peace deal doesn't include, say, ISIS, for example.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, there will be a Taliban 2.0 and a Taliban 3.0. And I think the best hope we have is that we have a low temperature insurgency for a decade or two. That's the best case scenario. Worst case scenario, we'll compromise on our values and the things that we've built over the last 20 years. And we'll bring these guys into our system. And yet the fighting will continue. But, you know, the world is lost patience. And I think if you look at the U.S. and you look at the elections and so forth, that they want to disengage. I mean, I think that, you know, across the political establishment, I think there's no one that says that we have to actually be engaged in the region. So that's very dangerous. And but, it, you know, it also makes sense for, you know, and President Trump has said this, that the rest of the world also needs to step up. And I think that, you know, whether it's India or Britain and others need to also step up. This is a global challenge for us and needs to be sort of dealt with in a way that we have to understand that's going to impact us for the next two or three decades at least.
How does the world deal with a state sponsor of terrorism?
Well, I think to your point, if they can target Qasem Soleimani, why can't they target a general that lives in Rawalpindi? The ISI has been, and again, in this book, in this chapter, this senior U.S. official confirms that how active they were in terms of their support of the Taliban. Listen, you cannot have a peace deal until the sanctuaries exist in those countries. And what the weapons and training and everything else and the funding they receive from Pakistan, it's contributed to 8,000 deaths, international casualties in Afghanistan. It's not something that you can ignore. But I think that what we're seeing in Doha and the negotiations, it's to an extent, it can be misinterpreted as a defeat. It's a surrender deal in the eyes of many.
And there's no real clarity as to what Pakistan's role will be in terms of this peace deal, what role they will take.
It's wishful thinking, but I think you have to look at history and how Pakistan has played its hand in the past. You know, whether it was after 9/11, whether it was in the 90s or even the 80s, I think for us to expect something different is a bit naive.
Aaron, Saad and the other panelists talked about ideology. I mean, what is so appealing about the ideology of terrorism that draws people to it?
Well, there's definitely a huge body of research behind the push and pull factors that lead people into violent extremist and terrorist groups. I wouldn't want to orientalize it. So actually, when you look at white supremacy terrorism or Islamist extremist terrorism or other forms of violent extremism, that process looks very similar. And oftentimes, people focus on the grievances. So feeling disenfranchised, feeling like you're part of a marginalized group. That would include a lot of people. And most people that have experienced those perhaps negative push factors, they're not going to become terrorists. What we do find, and I think the key ingredient that does drive people into these groups is the empowerment structure that it provides. And actually, that's one of the saddest things, is that maybe they're not finding that elsewhere, but that these groups are promising clarity. So they're taking all these confusing, very complex socio-political problems, and they're simplifying it into very easy to digest messaging of who is good and who is bad, why you are being marginalized, and they offer the solution, which is the most important part. They, in fact, offer a hero narrative whereby we've simplified what the problem is, and you are the hero that can help be part of the solution, and it's a very clear pathway. And dare I say, it's very hard to find that sort of simplified messaging in other empowerment structures, especially for young people. But when we look at Daesh, or the so-called Islamic State, we saw recruitment happen from a huge range of socio-political backgrounds, women that had PhDs that went and joined in some cases. We also saw people join from more criminal organizational backgrounds that had previous offenses, but we also saw people with engineering skills or basic accountancy skills. That's an interesting case study because building a state building like they were trying to do, is a very different and wider recruitment strategy than militant, violent, non-state armed group recruitment. So they were going above and beyond militant recruitment and actually looking to state build. When you look at other forms of violent extremism, like the white supremacy movements or extreme right-wing violent extremist movements across Europe and the US, similarly, they're offering a lot of comradeship, a lot of friendship and social networks, sometimes job opportunities. So the questions are really, how do you prevent people being allured by a false narrative in the first place? If they start getting involved in it, how do you counter that narrative as far as an online space is concerned? And then once somebody is within that network, how can you disengage them? And these demand multi-sector approaches. That includes the tech sector being at the table.
General Petraeus, who was here last year, talked about the physical caliphate no longer existing, but actually that's now moved to an online caliphate. You work for Facebook, and often there's a finger of blame on tech companies for not doing enough, for being negligent when it comes to cracking down on the radicalization that goes on online. How do you respond to that?
I would say that a lot has been done, especially in the last 5 years. The first thing is that most tech companies I'm on a policy team that just does counterterrorism and dangerous organizations. That team did not exist 5 years ago. Tech companies did not know that they had to hire in-house expertise on these topics. When you're developing a new piece of wonderful, beautiful technology, there's an idealism behind it, and you never think how horribly that tool could possibly be used. So I think we have, especially with the larger tech companies, we've come a long way. We have over 350 people at Facebook that just work on counterterrorism and dangerous organizations, and that's supported by over 35,000 people on different time zones on safety and operations teams that have different specialties, different language capacities, different cultural nuanced expertise, people coming from law enforcement backgrounds, legal backgrounds, practitioner backgrounds, but also engineering support. So for a tech company, it's really three questions. It's how can you build out that human expertise? Where can you use artificial intelligence and tooling to be more proactive in detecting these networks or violating pieces of content around terrorism? And then how do you build multi-sector partnerships? And so beyond the human expertise, already for artificial intelligence, we've taken tooling from other abuse areas. So we use photo and video matching technology that was learned from the child sexual abuse area of how to match around hashed pieces of technology so that we can detect it upon upload. We also can use things like language detection, better technology around recidivism, so that if you take down an account for some of these indicators, the same bad actor is prevented from returning. This takes a lot of engineering support and a lot of testing around false positives to make sure that we're not over-censoring. So it's important that we build in appeals processes. But partnerships-wise, what we've seen is the result is good. You know, in the first three quarters of last year, Facebook removed over 18 million pieces of terrorist content. That's a lot.
How much content are we seeing coming out daily from a group like ISIS today?
So if you look at the heyday of ISIS, they were releasing more than 200 unique pieces of propaganda each week. And that was in about 8 to 12 different languages, depending how fluently you look at it. There were spelling errors in some. And if you look at that now, it's a drip feed. It's very, very little. So as far as centralized, organized propaganda from the various, I think, 36 to 38 different branded media wings that they had at one point, we've gone down to a very tiny amount. However, the adversarial shift, when we talk about a virtual caliphate, is now the movement to smaller, less regulated platforms. So we aren't going to see the obvious stuff as much on Facebook. We're having to see where trails lead to, and we have to work across the tech sector. So it's part of the reason that in 2017, we formed the Global Internet Forum to Counterterrorism, GIFCT, and that was founded by Facebook, YouTube, Microsoft, and Twitter, and now includes a wide range of companies like Amazon, Dropbox, LinkedIn, Pinterest, ones that you wouldn't even normally think to come to the table, but we're all seeing the shift across platforms.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Raisina Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and for further updates, follow us on our social media and our website.